Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you very much for coming. I'm going to break two rules of Middle East meetings. One is we will not begin 15 minutes late. I apologize for those of you who are not here. The second is I'm not going to give a long introduction. I think you all know who Mr. Talabani is. I think you know that he has been working very, very actively with both the Kurdish PUK, the Kurdish government, and with the Iraqi government. And certainly this is a timing which I hope is going to be the start of a new, effective Iraqi government. It certainly could not be better time to have a meeting today when tomorrow we will have a video conference between the new Prime Minister and government of Iraq, President Bush, and his counterparts. So without any long introduction, let me introduce Mr. Talabani, who's going to be talking both about the new government and the political future of Iraq. Thank you.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's a pleasure to be here this morning. After spending about 6 weeks in Iraq, I'm excited to tell you about all the wonderful things that are happening in Iraq and some of the positive developments that I saw while I was out there, as well as some of the not-so-positive developments. Obviously, it was great to come back and hear the news of the killing of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, a major scourge on Iraq and on Middle East peace. That has to be a very significant development. It is not going to solve all of our problems, but at least it gives us an opportunity to move ahead and to hit al-Qaeda hard where it hurts. Al-Qaeda being the decentralized organization that it is, and especially in Iraq, the fact that there was no clear number two will certainly leave them somewhat disorganized at this point in time, and it is an ideal opportunity for us to hit them and make greater advancements against them. Unfortunately, there are many more Zarqawis to deal with, both in Iraq and throughout the Middle East region. Undoubtedly, his death comes as a major boost to the new Iraqi government, to the U.S. government, to the Iraqi population at large. Another positive observation was the formation of this national unity government. Now, many say it took too long to form, and it certainly did. We'd wished we would have had the government several weeks after the elections, but it took the time that it took to form this government. People were not sitting idly by those 5 or 6 months. There were intense discussions and deliberations between the various different political groups in Iraq to form this national unity government. And in my opinion, this government is as inclusive as it possibly could be. We couldn't get everybody under this umbrella, but we certainly have the main players involved. Those include the United Iraqi Alliance, the Kurdistan Alliance, the Sunni Accordance Front, and members of Ayad Alawi's Iraqi list. These make up the backbone of this government, and these are the groups that gained the most votes in the elections. We've had the appointment of some decent ministers to this new cabinet, technically capable, with patriotism and an intent to work as a cohesive unit to try to overcome some of the ethnic and sectarian differences that have really hampered the political progress over the last two administrations. We have, forming the presidency, members and representatives of three of Iraq's largest political blocs, the Kurds, the Shiites, and the Sunnis. The presidency council will undoubtedly prove to be a very powerful entity in this new government. And I'd like to say that the government has gotten off to a good start, where it's working together. The different branches of government are in dialogue with each other. They understand the need that needs to be done. And the ministers that have taken up their positions understand that corruption that was prevalent in the previous governments has been a major blow to the political progress, and they hope to address it as best they can. The institutionalization of the new Iraqi army is also a very, very positive development. The army has become far more capable and is becoming more and more capable by the day. They are organized and they are taking the lead in the fight to bring security, and they're taking the lead in many military operations going on in Iraq today. The fact that there had been a lot of embedding at even the lowest levels of the Iraqi army between the U.S. military and the Iraqi army has proven to be a major success because it has helped professionalize the Iraqi army. Aside from some civilians within the Ministry of Defense, the corruption is low within the army, and the patriotism and the dedication to fight the terrorism is admirable. More positive developments include what's going on in the Kurdistan region today, where there is improvement on the political and economic front. There is a construction boom in Kurdistan today. The area is becoming more and more conducive to international investment. The Kurdistan National Assembly, the regional parliament, is in the process of passing a very liberal business and investment law that will try to encourage a lot of foreign investment to the Kurdistan region. It's also becoming an area to carry out large-scale training programs for other parts of the country, whether it's in the police or in other security fields or even in public administration. We are hoping that the U.S. companies that currently have their Iraq headquarters in Amman, Jordan, or in Kuwait would think about relocating to the Kurdistan region, as technically it is part of Iraq. The newly unified Kurdistan regional government is also in the process of modernizing some of its laws, in particular as it pertains to freedom of speech, the issue of the media, and modernizing the laws that have sometimes prohibited media personnel from saying what they should say has hampered our progress, but the KRG is very serious about upholding the values and trying to improve civil society in our region. Iraq certainly faces many challenges, and none more daunting than addressing the security situation throughout the country. It has been made the priority of the new National Unity Government to bring security to two key cities in the country, Baghdad and Basra. Securing Iraq's two largest cities will be key to ensuring a viable state in Iraq. Baghdad is almost one-third of Iraq's population, and Basra has the potential to become the economic hub of the country. Quelling the sectarian violence can only be done by asserting control over the militias, a challenge that will fall mostly on the shoulders of the new Minister of Interior. The National Unity Government and the coalition forces are working together to devise and implement a plan that will secure Baghdad. And this will have a key element of this, mechanisms to deal with the rogue militias that are carrying out acts of terror against innocent civilians. The fact that the new Minister of Interior comes from a security background and is not closely affiliated with one group or another will allow him to work very closely with the Prime Minister and to be firm on this position of the militias. I've personally heard the Prime Minister on many occasions, both privately and publicly, state that he's going to work as a top priority to quell the sectarian violence and to put a stop to these elements of the Iraqi security forces that are carrying out these sectarian killings. Another main challenge of the Iraqi government will be to come up with an economic development plan. This plan will need to be strategic and will need to compensate and complement the plan to secure the country. Economic prosperity goes hand in hand with security in Iraq, and we cannot address one without the other. Building Iraq's economy will require a different strategy than that we hope to implement to secure the country. Rebuilding Iraq's economy will require us to work where we can. When we're talking about bringing security, we need to secure the two main cities of Baghdad and Basra. But in order to build Iraq's economy, we need to think larger than those two cities. There are many parts of that country where we can work to improve the economic stability and economic development. These are major parts of the south are today calm and quiet. Most of eastern Iraq is today calm and quiet. The Kurdish north, obviously, is very calm and quiet. By working where we can, we can implement small to medium-sized economic development projects. We'll be sending a message to our people, to the Iraqi people, that this government is more effective than the previous government and is actually serving the people of the country. Addressing the issue of Kirkuk is going to be key for the new government. This is a very explosive issue for Iraq. Kirkuk, as you all know, is a very multi-ethnic city. It has a terrible history of genocide and of ethnic cleansing, and we need to come up with a system that will address the repatriation of people who have been forcibly evicted from their homes. Any such policy to bring people back to their homes must not come at the expense of anyone that has to leave. Relocation and displacement is a very complex and messy issue, and obviously people are going to get hurt in this process. It is critical for us that anyone that is forced to leave their homes is also treated as a victim in this case, and coming up with a decent compensation plan can try to make this relocation less complex and less painful. What the country requires at this point is a true national reconciliation process. We need to create a national reconciliation process that allow the different communities in Iraq to air their grievances and to educate their fellow citizens on the effects of the former regimes on their lives. All sides have the grievances. The Shiites in Iraq will claim that for 1,400 years they've been oppressed. Kurds will tell you that for 100 years we've been oppressed. Sunnis will tell you that they've been oppressed since the ousting of Saddam Hussein. Most of these grievances are valid, and we cannot belittle any of them. But only through a national dialogue can we begin to heal some of the wounds that have caused so much pain over the last 80 years. We also need to make our governance more effective. Given Iraq's past and present, Iraq's communities have had little trust that somebody other than their own representative is going to look out for them. The chances of recreating a strong, centralized, effective government is looking less and less likely every day. Academic arguments for recreating strong, centralized governments do not fly with the citizens on the ground. People have had their lives ravaged for the last 80 years by strong, centralized governments. Institutionalizing federalism and devolving authority from the center, if managed correctly, will lead to more effective governance. As elected, regional officials will have a greater say over their governance and will have the opportunity to address the shortcomings of their constituencies rather than waiting for the cumbersome and bureaucratic central government to tackle their issues. The reality is that regardless of the fact that we have a national unity government or not, Iraq is beginning and continuing to polarize along sectarian or ethnic lines. These divisions were highlighted in the recent parliamentary elections, where nearly 90% of the population voted along ethnic or sectarian lines. We shouldn't be surprised by this fact, as Iraq was never formed as a voluntary union from its communities. But I'll spare you the history lesson. Most of you know the troubles of the formation of the state of Iraq. It's not likely that Iraq could be cut into three neat pieces, but it is likely that Iraq will end up having several strong regions that will manage the day-to-day affairs of their constituencies, with some or sometimes little oversight from the central government. This appears to be the wish of the majority of the Iraqi people, and this is not something that should come as a surprise to us. This is certainly not something, an issue that the U.S. government needs to decide on. This is not an issue that has to be decided on by institutions like CSIS or academic institutions in the United States. This is something that has been decided on by the government of Iraq and by the majority of the people of Iraq, and it is outlined in Iraq's constitution that this is the way the country should go forward. Shiites and Kurds have long sought this as a path to solve Iraq's ethnic and sectarian problems. Sunnis are also coming to the realization that by devolving power from the central government, this will be their only protection against a Shiite-dominated government in Baghdad, which is creating the argument, which is solidifying really the argument for strong regions versus the strong central government. The concern for them as well as for others is the critical issue of managing Iraq's natural resources. The Arabs coming up with a natural resources policy that addresses both the concerns of the regions and their grievances for greater demand and say over the development of the oil and gas sector, and also finding a way of distributing the revenues equitably, ensuring that the oil resources of the country belong to all the people of the country, is going to be key and is going to be very complicated and will require wisdom and negotiation and discussions among all of Iraq's leaders. Ultimately, we need to create a balance where all of the power and all of the decision-making entities, all of the decision-making powers do not lie in the hands of one entity. By creating a partnership between the regions and the federal government, we can create a system that ensures that the needs of the regions are met while ensuring relative and decent oversight into the development of the oil sector. Tackling corruption is going to be a major issue, again, for the government. It has plagued us since the formation of the previous governments. The corruption has been prevalent throughout the society, and some of it has been very blatant and has been a major source of discontent from our population. The people deserve better, and it is important that this new government sees addressing the issue of corruption as a major priority. Unfortunately, we collectively, both as Kurds, Iraqis, and Americans, have been too focused on finding personalities to lead this country rather than building sound and solid institutions. And this has led to some of the corruption that we've had over the last two, three years by institutionalizing our government, by creating checks and balances and oversight and accountability within our system. We can help curb the horrible corruption that we've been plagued with over the past 3 years. An issue that is being discussed in Iraq today and will undoubtedly become more and more open to the public and especially to the U.S. policymakers is the issue of U.S. troop reduction and troop withdrawals. We feel that it is time to begin this discussion about the U.S. and international presence in Iraq. However, we stress that these discussions need to be managed very carefully. Any decision to reduce the troop numbers in Iraq must be A, conditional on the progress on the political, economic, and security front in the country, and B, phased. By phased, I mean that you cannot just have an immediate withdrawal or withdrawal of large numbers of U.S. troops. We strongly feel that first and foremost, we need to get the coalition forces out of the cities, out of the urban populated areas, and to take them and put them in rural areas out of sight and less likely to cause tensions or disturbances among the populations. By gradually retreating them to special bases in designated parts of the country in accordance and in agreement with the Iraqi government, we can begin to effectively withdraw the U.S. presence in the country, providing once again, I state once again, that we meet certain political, economic, and security goals. We certainly feel in Kurdistan that the U.S. should consider having some troops in the Kurdistan region. It is, again, a very pro-American part of the world, and it's an area where the majority of the Kurdish people actually would prefer to have U.S. presence there, as we feel that it is a deterrent to some of our prying neighbors who are seeking to interfere in our internal affairs. But ultimately, that is, again, another decision that has to be made by the Iraqi government with the coalition partners and the regional governments. I'd like to take this opportunity to give a special mention to the U.S. ambassador in Iraq, who really has worked tirelessly to try to overcome some of the differences in the country, has sought to bridge the differences between the Shiites and Sunnis, and was really instrumental in bringing the Sunni political movements involved into the political process. We're proud to say that today the Sunnis are part of the political process. The largest groups, the largest political movements are engaging on a day-to-day basis on the development of the country, and this is a very, very positive development, and we hope that this cohesive entity as the new National Unity Government can continue to work as a cohesive unit. To conclude, I'll state that I'm more optimistic than I have been for a long time. It is going to be difficult to win this battle, to ensure that we have a viable state in the country. This new government having a mandate for 4 years is another promising fact. It's not a six-month government. It's not a 10-month government. The government can put together and start working on building short-term plans to address the current issues while also trying to put in place mechanisms that will ensure long-term prosperity. The U.S. assistance and the international assistance in this endeavor, be it political, be it military, be it financial, is going to be critical. We cannot do this alone. We've proven that we cannot do this alone. But I think as time moves on, the role of the international community is going to change from what it is today. We will hope to move from security-type relations to trade, economic, and political relations. And I think that will be something that we'll see over the next 2 or 3 years. While there are many reasons to criticize the decisions that have been made over the past 3 years in Iraq, now is the time for institutions like CSIS and our friends in the United States to help us constructively. As the political debate in Washington intensifies, we fear that Iraq is going to become a tool in the hands of the politicians as the political debate in Iraq intensifies. We anticipate that al-Qaeda will fight its battle with the United States on our turf, but we don't anticipate and don't need the United States fighting their internal battle on our turf. I could talk for a lot more, but I think it'll be more useful to turn it over to have a Q&A to answer some of the difficult questions that I'm sure you'll have for me.
Ladies and gentlemen, let me open things up for questions. I do have a couple of favors to ask. One is that we can't see you behind these lights, but in any case, it's important that when you do get recognized, you wait for the microphone and you identify yourself. Second, if you look around, you can see how crowded the room is. I think that we all recognize that a question ends in a question mark. And if I may add another definition, if a question has more than two parts, it has become a speech. So if I may ask you to operate on those principles, I'd be very grateful. And let me open things up. Yes, please.
Good morning. I'm Bob Dreyfus from Rolling Stone magazine, and I have a exactly two-part question. Part one is, do you take issue at all with the Leslie Gelb, Joe Biden plan, which seemed to be pointing in the way of dividing Iraq neatly into three pieces, as you said, probably wouldn't happen? And the second part of the question is, Leslie Gelb has talked about the United States creating permanent bases in the Kurdish region, and also today in the New York Times there's a mention that the Bush administration is considering 50,000 troops for years, if not decades, in Iraq. Is there any way you could foresee the Iraqi government as a whole, all of its parts, accepting the continued presence of about, 50,000 troops in Iraq for a long time to come?
Thanks, Bob. The issue of the Gelb-Biden peace, the three-state solution, is not a new concept. And it's actually, if you kind of break down what they had said in their article, and what actually Les Gelb has been saying for quite some time is that Iraq has been kept together as a strong centralized state by tyranny over the years. And this has proven to be ineffective. It has proven to be not the way to govern a country. You've had many communities that have many, many grievances over this. So to come up with a solution where you can give administrative powers to different regions, that it's in their vested interests to invest in those regions, to develop those regions, has to make sense as the way forward. Now, whether it's three states or five states or six states, that the people of the country can determine. I don't think it can break up into three neat pieces. You have Baghdad as the political capital. Where would Baghdad fall into? I mean, many people say that if Iraq were to have these strong federal regions, that Baghdad should retain its own special status. I wouldn't say like D.C., but something along those lines, where it's the federal government, it's the capital of the federal government. I don't think the Shiite region could become one bloc. I think there are a lot of issues within the south that may end up creating two or three different regions in the south. But the issue here shouldn't be a discussion about the details. It should be about the concept. The concept of taking away power from a strong centralized authority and giving it to the people of the regions that want to effectively govern themselves. And again, it goes back to also the history of this country. The trust is weak. The people in the Sunni regions do not feel that a Shiite-dominated government is going to look out for them. The Kurds, we're suspicious of everybody. The Shiites fear that one day the Sunnis are going to come back to dominate the country. So the way to address this and alleviate the concerns of these different communities is to empower them to manage their own affairs. I don't think Mr. Gelb or Biden also certainly don't want to make the central government irrelevant, but it's about creating a mechanism where you devolve enough authority to the regions and maintain oversight and regulatory powers to the central government. As far as your second question about bases in the Kurdistan region, again, this discussion between the Kurdistan regional government and the United States has been going on for some time. For us and for a lot of people, it makes a lot of sense because it is a stable, secure part of the country. It's a place where people actually like the Americans and want them to be there. But at the same time, it would create a difficult situation if the central government of Iraq opposed the deployment or the basing of U.S. troops in the Kurdistan region, and the Kurdistan region itself wanted the U.S. troops. This comes back to a larger state versus central government issue that we see on a daily basis here in the United States. I can see it as feasible that we would have U.S. troops in the Kurdistan region for some time, whether 50,000 or 20,000 or 10,000. I couldn't go into details because we're not at that point in the discussion yet.
Thank you very much. The gentleman on the front row, could we have the mic, please?
Colonel Dutta, Foreign Policy Association, Your Excellency, my question is that federal system is enshrined in the Constitution of Iraq. What is the future of the militias in the various provinces, also especially that of Peshmerga? Will it be merged with the Central Defense Force?
A very good question, and something that's being discussed as we speak and has been continued to be discussed since the fall of the regime. What's happened with the Peshmerga since the fall of Saddam is as follows. Many elements of the Peshmerga, these are the regional defense forces of the Kurdistan, have been integrated into the new Iraqi army. They make up key components of the northern divisions. But at the same time, we have retained also sizable portions of the Peshmerga to act as regional defense forces, whose jurisdiction lies solely within the Kurdistan region. These are organizationally connected to the Ministry of Interior in Baghdad, but ultimately have their own chain of command that goes through the commander of the regional defense forces in the Kurdistan region. So you have the best of both worlds. It's similar to having a National Guard system you have here in the United States, other than the fact that they are almost always active duty and not reserve elements. Again, it'll take a long time for there to be one national army in Iraq because of the history, because of the blood and the turmoil and the genocide that Iraq has faced. Today, the people of the Kurdistan region could not tolerate the disbanding of the Peshmerga and the deployment of the Iraqi army to their region. So it's a way of coming up with a solution that addresses both the history and also the realities of Iraq.
Thank you. The gentleman in the second row.
Chase Kavanaugh of Reuters. Your Excellency, I'd like to ask, what is your current opinion of, from the point of view of Kurdistan and the unity government, towards Iran?
Iran is a neighbor and is a powerful neighbor, and we share a very, very long border with Iran. We have expressed our concern to the government of Iran over allegations and some evidence that Iran has been meddling in the internal affairs of Iraq. We hope that Iran will continue to play a constructive role in helping us as we move forward, but at the same time, we are concerned about some involvement in a negative manner by the government of Iran in Iraq.
I wonder if I may take the moderator's prerogative and ask you to address a question you didn't touch on. One of the challenges the new government faces fairly quickly is to clarify the Constitution, and that will require yet another approach to unity and politics. And I wonder if you could discuss how that's going to take place and what you think the timing might be.
There are still, I think, 58 or 59 laws that need further clarification or resolution by the new Iraqi parliament on this constitution. And this just highlights the challenges that we face as we move forward. There is a window of opportunity of 4 months since the day that the government gets formed to open the issue of the Iraqi constitution and the possibility of making amendments to this constitution. And I think that once people get settled in their current positions and we begin on this process of this new government, that this issue of the discussion of possible amendments to this constitution will become more and more intense. It is an opportunity to give those that were not part of the constitutional drafting process an opportunity to have their say But ultimately, all decisions have to be approved by a two-thirds majority from the Iraqi National Assembly. It won't be easy to make amendments, but I think the importance here is to give people the opportunity to voice their opinions and to voice their concerns and to try to convince the other Iraqi policymakers that these amendments are necessary.
Yes, please.
Guy Dinmore, Financial Times. Welcome back, Kuba.
Thanks.
Can you say where is the money going to come from for all these big projects, especially on the reconstruction front, given that your oil revenues are falling and there's a lack of commitment, perhaps, in America to keep paying for this? Thank you.
Well, first and foremost, if we can curb the corruption that has been going on in the oil ministry, the Iraqi government will have a sizable budget to carry out and continue its economic development projects. I mean, we've had a disastrous year in terms of trying to keep Iraq's money in the country, and we have a capable minister of oil in Shahristani to be able to hopefully effectively govern that ministry. We know that the money from the United States Congress and the American people is drying up, but we hope that others will step forward and help us in this endeavor. The international community is large, and we have very wealthy and prominent neighbors that can help us develop our country. It should be in their interest to develop Iraq and to bring stability and prosperity to Iraq, and I think what's required is some sort of compact with the international community that helps us along this path. And this cannot be just us doing it alone. We need involvement. We need more international conferences that can focus on the economic development. I think up until now we have focused too much on the political development in Iraq and too much on rebuilding Iraq's security forces, and we haven't focused enough on the need to build up Iraq's economy and the need to build partnerships with our friends and neighbors in the international community to help us achieve those goals. A combination of utilizing our own resources better in a more accountable and transparent way with teaming up with the international community will, I think, go a long way to address some of our financial shortcomings and to help us develop some of these larger infrastructure development projects that we have lined up.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm having a little trouble with the lights because I can't see you. There's a question in back, but if from now on you'd stand, it would make it easier to see you and get you the microphones.
Yasemin Çongar, Milliyet and CNN Türk. Mr. Talabani, you mentioned the possibility, or rather the fear of neighbors interfering in Iraqi Kurdistan. One reason Turkey might interfere, as you know, is the presence of PKK in the region. How do you think that the problem will be solved ultimately? Do you see this as an issue between the regional government in the north and Ankara, or rather the central government of Iraq and Turkey? Thank you.
The issue of the PKK is an important issue for the regional government and also for the Iraqi government. And we understand its importance to the government of Turkey. And I think only through a political dialogue between Ankara, between Baghdad and the Kurdistan region can we address this issue. There is no military solution to the PKK problem. There is a political solution to the PKK problem, but this political solution requires a serious dialogue with the key players involved. We have expressed our willingness to help resolve this PKK issue. It is not in the best interests of Iraq to have the PKK in Iraqi Kurdistan. It is in the best interest of all involved to come up with a solution that gives major portions of the PKK a general amnesty that will allow these people to go home, return to civilian life, to lay down their arms, and we feel that through a political solution we can address most, if not all, of the PKK problems.
If I can add a question, the United States has talked about the problems that grew out of the Ministry of Interior and the police force in creating a year of the police. There also has been an issue of how do you get courts, a criminal justice system, present throughout Iraq. And I wonder if you could talk about what this means from an Iraqi perspective and the kind of progress that you hope for.
The Ministry of Interior has been problematic, and the police have also been a major problem for all of us involved, and there is this disparity between the security forces under the control of the Ministry of Defense, which appear to have had a greater level of American teaming than those of the Ministries of Interior. And I think there was the issue was, at the onset, our strategy for recreating the Iraqi police force was wrong. We just sent out a general call offering good salaries for anyone that wished to join the police. And we didn't do enough vetting, we didn't do enough background checks, and we didn't do enough questioning on the loyalty and intent of these police forces before they were recruited. And I think this issue of the year of the police is a nice slogan, but putting it into effect is not going to be easy. But I think it has become one of the priorities of the new government in Iraq. And it's ultimately about creating a professional police force that is dedicated to the country of Iraq rather than political parties or certain militias. This will take time, this will take money, this will take training, this will take a very deep process of vetting. And it's not about numbers. We can all flash amazing numbers of, I don't know, 200,000 security personnel in Iraq, whether they're ministries of interior or defense, but large numbers here are not going to address our issues. It's about having competent and qualified people. The same with the judicial system and trying to maintain its independence from the executive branch of the government. We have to also preserve the secular nature of Iraq's court system and try to limit the encroachment by the religious authorities in Iraq's judiciary. No small feat, but again, through effective governance, through creating institutions, through empowering people, we can start to address these critical issues.
Yes, please. The microphone's clear.
Be gentle, Dick.
Well, thank you. Dick Knob. Friend of the Kurds. I noted your second largest city, Basra. Those of us who love the North would argue that Mosul and, of course, the governor of Nineveh is very important to the KRG, but also to the central government. I wonder, you're not mentioning it, is it? Hasn't been in the news much lately. Have they found a recipe for success there for the security problems they had?
We haven't quite found the recipe for success in Mosul. There have been a major decrease in number of attacks against coalition forces and against Iraqi targets in Mosul, which is always good news. And if it's not in the news, that means it's great, because we all know that our friends in the media like to portray the bad news in Iraq. Sorry, Guy, I'm looking over in your direction. But Mosul is a problem. It does house the largest number of former Iraqi officers, senior Iraqi officers, senior members of the Iraqi Ba'ath Party. It had been heavily influenced by the Wahhabi Islamists, the militants. Al-Qaeda had for a long time set up a major base of operations in Mosul. Through joint efforts by the regional forces and the coalition forces, we were able to remove a lot of the bad elements from Mosul. We didn't get them out of the country. They have just mainly dispersed to other parts of the country. But ultimately, we all are guilty of only focusing on the trouble spots. And today, Basra has exploded into a major trouble spot for the country. That is not to say Mosul will not once again cause us problems, given its proximity to Syria, given the makeup of Mosul, again, being a multi-ethnic city, and given the history that Mosul has. But I think we have reformed the police force in Mosul. The Iraqi army division that is based near there is effective. The governor is liked by the majority of the people that wish the city good. And the fact that the U.S. is playing a greater role in Mosul in helping build up the security forces is also something very, very positive. The Iraqi security forces are in Mosul.
I can follow up on that. We have heard a number of statements cautioning us that Zarqawi dying and the much broader range of attacks on al-Qaeda has affected a movement which U.S. officers have said is 10 to 12% of the insurgency. And I wonder if you could characterize your view of how the insurgency has developed and how it will act as a threat in the future.
This insurgency too often gets labeled as one monolithic entity, the insurgency. But we all know that this so-called insurgency is made up of several components, varying in size, varying in effectiveness, and varying in methods of attacks against Iraqi civilians. We have the al-Qaeda types, the foreign militant Islamists and foreign militant groups that are in the country, which in my opinion probably make up the smallest number in terms of personnel, but have been able to cause the most devastating attacks. These are the ones that are targeting innocent civilians, women and children, schools, hospitals, so-called soft targets. We have the former Saddam loyalists and former senior Ba'ath Party members, former senior Iraqi military officers that have not been able to be integrated into the new Iraq, which make up a large portion of the insurgency. There is an ongoing dialogue today between the Iraqi government and elements of the, I don't like to call them the Sunni insurgency, because they're not. It's not the Sunni insurgency. It is more the angry ex-Ba'athist, ex-military officers. And we are trying to find out who within this group can take part in the new government, who have too much blood on their hands and won't be accepted into the society, or certainly in terms of the posts within the security institutions. An element that we haven't been able to curb, reach out to, or address is general crime, organized crime, mafias. These are things that are emerging, are becoming more and more prevalent throughout daily life in Iraq. Kidnappings, most of the kidnappings that are being carried out by mafia gangs who know a wealthy family or who know somebody who's prominent in either in government or is related to somebody prominent in government. Tackling this issue is a law enforcement issue. Is obviously going to require the development of our law enforcement services. One element of the insurgency that doesn't get much publicity, in my opinion, is the average Iraqi citizen. Now, while the citizen is not an active member of the insurgency, but their acquiescence to the existence of these insurgencies is, in effect, helping them. The PUK, the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, was an insurgency movement against the Iraqi government for decades. We could not have survived without the support of our population, which is why it's critical, as this government develops, that we put together a plan to win over the population, to get them on the side of the government, to stop this acquiescence. Ultimately, that's going to be the way to defeat this insurgency and to root out the terrorism. We can build political institutions as much as we want. We can build Iraq's security institutions to a very effective and capable measures. But if we don't get the people on board, we're going to have this problem for many, many years to come.
I'm Frank Verastro at CSIS. Mr. Talabani, welcome, and thank you for coming back. My question's on energy and oil, in part because of the increased security in the north. We understand that there's small contracts that have been let, and there's work actually going on in drilling and new activity in the Kurdish region. Mm-hmm. Since the petroleum law hasn't been finalized or made change because of the Constitution, what do you envision the reaction to contracts that are ongoing? Will they be grandfathered or amended, or is that national or regional discretion?
Well, it depends on how you interpret the current constitution. The current constitution states that existing oil fields will be managed and administered by the central government, and future oil fields, which could be determined as fields that have been found since Operation Iraqi Freedom, are to be administered by the regional governments. Now, what you have here are two different issues. Issues of administration of the resources and issues related to the revenues of those resources. Now, going ahead with smaller projects to develop potential oil fields is well within the rights of the Kurdistan region in accordance to Iraq's constitution. It'll be years before we even talk about revenue distribution, and it'll take that long probably to come up with the right mechanism and right formula to be able to effectively distribute the revenues gleaned from those resources. What we feel is that there is no need to wait for that discussion to go ahead with the initial stages of looking into the development of the oil sector into the Kurdistan region.
Sarah Afshar from Booz Allen Hamilton. Your Excellency, one of the comments you made, which I found very intriguing from a policy standpoint, was a lack of a desire for the United States to fight their fight on Iraqi turf. What would you say to U.S. policymakers in terms of how they break down which threats are, in fact, U.S. Against U.S. and which are against Iraq? Additionally, you mentioned a desire to have U.S. troops within Kurdistan. There are the other areas of the world U.S. Supports and capacity building. Do you envision that kind of relationship? So I guess it's kind of two parts, but if you could define a little further for me, I'd appreciate that.
My comment about the U.S. fighting its fight in Iraq was related to the Iraq-U.S. political fight between the Republicans and Democrats. We're reluctant to have this fight being fought on our turf in Iraq. And ultimately, we understand that the debate that is going on in the United States today is a valid debate. Your public opinion, your American citizens have a right to ask questions as to the validity of this war, as to the duration of this war, to how long your brothers and sisters are going to be in our country. But what we ask is that people bear in mind that this debate, which may appear to be a very valid debate, by the time it gets to Iraq, it gets translated as a wavering of the U.S. commitment to seeing this project through in Iraq. And this affects the morale of our government, it affects the morale of our citizens, and it also boosts the morale of the terrorists and those that mean us harm. So we understand that there's an election year. We know that there is going to be a lot of discussion and debate about the Iraq issue. I think one thing that we fear should not get debated is the wavering of the U.S. commitment to see this through. The U.S. has invested too much in this effort to pull out prematurely. You've invested your lives, you've invested your money, you've invested your reputations, and we strongly feel that through working together we can achieve success here. I'm not being a blind optimist. And as far as U.S. presence in Iraq, I think the U.S. still has a lot to offer Iraq, whether it's the Kurdistan region or the rest of the country. We can learn a lot from your models. We can learn a lot from your success. We can learn a lot from your free market. And I think that in terms of building up capacity, improving our civil society, linking up Iraqi institutions with American institutions, having CSIS open up a branch in Iraq one day is all going to go a long way to helping us reintegrate into the international community and to raise the awareness of our public servants, of our population. And I'm optimistic.
Yes, please.
Daniel Kriener from the German Embassy. Your Excellency, when you say the U.S. and other members of the coalition or the international community shouldn't pull out prematurely, where do you see sort of the scale, maybe not in a certain specific time frame of months, but in general, where do you see a time frame where sort of, you know, that time of being premature ends and where sort of a right place in time, a right spot in time would be for a drawdown. Thank you.
I think one indicator will be the competency and the ability of the Iraqi security forces to take over from the multinational forces. There are parts of the country today that are being controlled and secured by Iraqi security forces. And we hope that by professionalizing these forces, by continuing to train them and equip them, and I'd just like to add here that we've made good progress on the training. We've made good progress on the battle hardness and battle readiness of our forces, but they're still very ill-equipped. We still have terrorists that have more modern, newer technology and heavier equipment than our our own military forces. So this is something that I think we'll be pressing the U.S. government and others for to kind of speed up the equipping of our security forces. But obviously, as we continue to build up those forces and they gain in confidence and they gain in ability to secure the areas and we improve on our law enforcement and ultimately start to make vast improvements in the lives and in the economy of the different regions, we can begin to transfer the security portfolios to the Iraqi security services. And only then can we start gradually drawing down on the multinational presence in Iraq. And it is going to be a phased approach. We do hope that it is conditional on those three factors of the political security, the actual security apparatus strengthening, and also on the economic development.
In the back, the young lady with the...
I'm Hannah Bouchekhi, Al-Mustaqbal Arabi magazine. Mr. Talabani, I have two questions. The first question is, are there any plans to help Iraqi people integrate into Iraqi society? And the second question is, when do you anticipate Iraqi government will be able to function without the presence of U.S. and international troops? Thank you.
I'm not sure about your first question about integrating the Iraqi people into Iraqi society. But as far as when the Iraqi government can function without the presence of the United States is, who can answer that question? I mean, it's ultimately, it depends on so many different factors that it would be foolish for me to tell you that by this date we'll be able to do everything by ourselves without the need of Americans. We're not in a rush to get rid of our friends from the international community. Because the assistance that we're getting from the international community is not just military. We want their political support, we need economic support, we need institutional support. So it's not a discussion as to when we can function on our own. We want to function on our own as quickly as we can. And that's going to be the priority of the new government, to work to build its institutions in a way that it can govern itself to the best that it can. But we all understand that it is going to take a while for us to be able to do this by ourselves. And, you know, we are seeing some certain sectors where the Iraqi governments and Iraqi ministries are, there are very few U.S. or coalition advisors in those ministries, but other areas will require greater presence for a longer period of time.
I wonder if I could ask you about just the conditions of ordinary life and how you see what may happen over the coming year. There is very large-scale unemployment. There's still problem with water, sewers, electric power, education, just medical services. When it comes down to the conditions that ordinary Iraqis face, how can the government move forward in these areas?
You know, the condition of people's lives depends on the region that they're in. And again, Iraq is a very large country, and unfortunately, because of the insurgency and because of the violence, we tend to focus only on the trouble spots. But there are areas of the country where people are going about their daily lives. The Marsh Arabs, for example, in the south, have really returned to the way of life they used to live for hundreds of years. After Saddam drained these marshes, the first thing that the Iraqi government did was to reflood the areas and are giving people an opportunity to cultivate their lands and to go about living a way of life that they've lived for centuries. Services need to be improved. So the health sector is rotten. The electricity sector is rotten. There isn't a sector in Iraq which we can safely say is functioning effectively. And this is a result of mismanagement for 50 years. It's a result of sanctions of the last 15 years. It's a result of war. It's a result of insurgencies. It's a result of ineffective governance. But there is a drive by the ministers, by the government, and hopefully by the coalition forces to improve on every sector. And we have to set our targets. We have to work both on the short term and addressing the immediate needs of the people, but at the same time trying to put in place a long-term strategy to help build those different infrastructure areas up. But there are major portions. I mean, 13 out of the 18 provinces in Iraq today are calm and quiet, and people are going about their daily lives. But the four or five provinces where we hear the news, hear the violence every day, tends to overshadow the success in most of the country. And I think that over the next year or so, we'll have a much better idea of what's going on, because I think that we're getting more information out of Iraq. And that information, whether it's from the press corps, whether it's from the Iraqi governing institutions, or whether it's from the U.S., is going to hopefully create a more realistic picture of what Iraq's going through today.
Ladies and gentlemen, I think we have time for one last question. Yes, please.
My name is Ahmed Hawass. I'm from the Osgo Center for International Studies. Your Excellency, I want to know your thoughts about the millions and millions of dollars that have been granted to Iraq. Don't you think that there's been so much of corruption and money embezzlement from both the military and the Iraqi government that have slowed down the pace of Iraqi reconstruction? And what do you think should happen? Do you think that the government should, I mean, if the problem is still persisting, what do you think the government should do? Thank you.
It's been as crippling to us as the insurgency, this issue of corruption. Whether it's being carried out by Iraqi government officials, whether it's being carried out by foreign contractors in the country, whether it's being carried out by political parties in the country, it has been a major detriment to our success. I'm pleased to say that we have a commission on public integrity that has undertaken a very, very intense study, an in-depth study on the practices of all the different ministries, of the political parties, of the government, and some of these reports are just mind-blowing. The millions that have been squandered, that have been embezzled, that have been stolen, will infuriate a lot of people when these things become public. The important thing is to move on from this and to make these people accountable. That we have ministers who are accused of stealing millions and millions of dollars, and it's important that this new government puts these people to trial. And this is going to be a key issue. It's probably going to include an international law enforcement issues, because most of the really bad guys have left the country. So Interpol will get involved. But this is going to be key for the new government. And then they're stressing the importance of this, because if we can effectively manage our own resources, we can make significant successes on the road to recovery here. I cannot stress to you the importance of this, the anti-corruption drive that is going on. And it's just been a real shame that so many people have gotten away with so much for so long.
Ladies and gentlemen, I think all of us share a common hope that Iraq will move forward. I think we all realize that this is the kind of struggle which has to be won at the political level and won by the people in the country. And I'd like to thank His Excellency very much for being so frank, for covering so many issues. It's been a pleasure, and thank you. And please join me in a round of applause.
Thank you.